You're listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco, and this is Reality Sandwich, where each Thursday at noon we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, the body, our planet, everything pertinent having to do with our collective existence here on planet Earth. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist and healthful living advocate with Healthful Living.
And I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living. And we are going to do our best to make this topic palatable today.
Yes, we are, Julie. Last Thursday, we spoke once again on the subject of peak oil. And you can hear that show at Reality Sandwich Radio. About 3 weeks ago, San Francisco was the first city in the United States to pass a resolution to respond and prepare to the pressures and realities of peak oil coming down the pike any time now. I spoke briefly with Supervisor Ross Mercurimi, who put the resolution forth in the city. Here's what he had to say about peak oil.
What should people know about this? If San Francisco citizens are just now catching an ear about this notion of peak oil, in your opinion, why is this so important and why is the city taking some action here?
Well, there's a number of reasons why it's important. Frankly, I think this illegal and misguided war abroad in Iraq is not really just about democracy. It's about oil, and it's about our sort of hegemonic interest over that part of the world due to our oil demand and need here in the United States. We have a very consumptive society. It's very reliant, over-reliant on oil, and you can see the gas prices is an indicator of that. I don't think anybody would argue that there is not an infinite supply of oil, so while there is great distress and taxing on the supply of oil, we're going to continue to see the price of oil per barrel just going through the roof. And I believe that municipalities throughout the United States have a responsibility to start to prepare themselves for either the inevitability of when oil supplies become so limited and so bleak that we need alternative energy sources and lifestyles in anticipation of that, and or when oil supplies become so limited and we are digging deeper and further down for more crude, dirtier oil, we better prepare ourselves for the environmental, social environmental consequences of that probability as well.
Today on the show, we are speaking with the editor and publisher of the online news source, FromTheWilderness.com, Mr. Michael Rupert. Mike, are you on the line?
I certainly hope so.
Yes, you are. Mike's website has been reporting on the realities of our global machinations and all that's going on around the globe for the past many, many years. He is an investigator. He is a writer. He is a speaker of truth. Mike looks at circumstances and puts pieces of reality together in ways that we can begin to make sense and perhaps collectively comprehend what's really going on in our world today. So it is with great honor that I'm speaking with you today, Mike, because our show is about Reality Sandwich, and we do our best to share with folks what's really going on. You spoke last weekend at a conference in New York on local solutions to the energy dilemma. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you. It's really good to be with you. How are things down in the Bay Area today?
Well, it's sunny for a change, and it's actually quite nice.
Good.
Now, we would love to speak to you. You know, you just heard that piece from Ross. We spoke last week about peak oil on the show again, and it would be incredible to get some insights really about now, you know, what is going on with peak oil? What's the state of shifts that are happening in our world right now? What can San Francisco do to respond? What can any city do if they wake up to this reality that's in front of us?
Well, San Francisco is not the only city to have begun this awakening process, but I heartily support and was really pleased to hear of the resolution. Denver is very much aware of peak oil. I was there last fall and spoke with the Denver Mayor John Hickenlooper. Portland is aware. Other smaller cities around the region are aware, but San Francisco is far and away the biggest city to do that, and I just say yahoo. That's the good news. The bad news is what good does it do if San Francisco passes a resolution in May and peak oil hits in July? And that's what we're looking at. We're looking at a summer that is going to be probably unlike any summer we have experienced in this country, maybe ever. inventories of oil are low. It looks like we may have passed peak production already. But if you throw into that mix a rapidly deteriorating economic climate, that includes the dollar, which is now close to free fall, gold prices, which are going through the roof, weakening financial markets, a collapsing housing bubble, an overly strained U.S. consumer, and you mix that up with instability in everywhere from Iran to Iraq to Afghanistan to West Africa to Southeast Asia, South America, all over the world now, plus a new hurricane season coming upon us, and you can see that we're kind of walking into the valley of the shadow right now.
On your website right now, there's an article that you wrote, a speech actually that you gave last week, and you refer to one of your writers, Dmitry
Orlov, yes.
Yes, and you note here something that I find quite fascinating. You say here that in October 2004, there were 16,300 documents listed in search engines that connected economic collapse with peak oil.
Yes.
And then 1 year later, in April of 2005, there were 4,220,000 such documents connecting economic collapse and peak oil as far as on the internet search engines.
Right.
And then you clearly point out that there's only, in your opinion, one thing as to that could be behind why this topic and why these things have not been discussed in the major media.
That has to do with the financial markets. That has to do with this economic paradigm that we live in. We are, in a certain sense, trapped in, but actually in other senses we are not, which is based on fiat currency, fractional reserve banking, debt-based growth, which requires infinite growth to sustain itself. It's a pyramid scheme.
Mm.
And without growth, the financial markets collapse. And on our website at www.fromthewilderness.com, we have many, many, many economic stories, both by myself and former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz, other great economic thinkers. And basically, until you change the way money works, you're not going to change anything in the current world paradigm, which is leading on a crash course toward war. I mean, a global war, perhaps. God forbid, a nuclear conflict. And all of the control rods, if you will, are essentially pulled out because with the U.S. and China and India and Russia and Germany, et cetera, all living in this paradigm that demands infinite growth, the conflicts now are inevitable because there's only so much oil. And the world's producing maybe 84 million barrels a day now, and demand has probably passed that to 85 million barrels a day. President Bush has already tapped the Strategic Petroleum Reserve once. He's now stopped filling it. Other nations are dipping into their reserves. So this is a very tight situation in which there is no elasticity, and that's the trap that we're really in. So when I talk to people about how to prepare for peak oil, I encourage them that while it's good to support the San Francisco resolution, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if we may be having serious dislocative problems this summer, it's the wrong idea to wait for government to do something. We have to start taking action individually and locally by community.
Mike, historically, when people hear this kind of information, it's so easy for them to tune out. And in your article, and we just mentioned that point about how much more data and information and stuff is going on in the world, and why isn't this getting mainstream media news? Why aren't people talking about this? The word denial comes up here.
Denial, denial, denial. I mean, it's a cliched line with me that I've overused over the years, but denial is not a river in Egypt. It's a mental illness. It is something that in nature is not adaptive behavior in that it doesn't promote survival. We've taken the philosophy, and I think many people now in the peak oil movement, and there are a great many. I salute the Post Carbon Institute run by Julian Darley. They're featured on our homepage. And other major leaders now in the peak oil movement, all of whom were in New York City. We have all adopted the attitude out of necessity that you go into something like a triage mode, where I guess the analogy would be like if the Titanic were sinking, it had been hit by the iceberg, you knew it was going to sink, and there was one group of people who said, show us how to build lifeboats, another group of people hysterically just running around like chickens with their heads cut off, and another group saying, oh, this ship will never sink, I'm going back to the bar for a drink. Which group would you spend your energy on? You would spend your energy on the group of people who knew that there was a problem and wanted to build lifeboats immediately. And that's, I think, the only right approach at this point.
We could not agree more. Hence the reason for us being here every Thursday, trying to do our best to share some reality with folks. Denial is very, very strong. And when we begin to look at the human psyche, we can understand the reasons for it, because people are scared out of their wits.
Mm-hmm. But that's not going to help anybody survive.
No.
And in point of fact, though, I mean, and this is really good news. I mean, I'm aware that all over the country, in probably more places than anybody has yet identified, there are post-carbon outposts, there are groups and communities who are totally aware. I've just relocated to Southern Oregon, and this is a beehive of activity, preparing to get off the grid. You have towns in Northern California like Willits that are doing that right now. They're way far ahead. So that's what we want to support wherever we find it. And the fact that you're in a big city, as opposed to being in a rural or semi-rural area, like some of us are fortunate enough to be, doesn't mean you don't have choices. There are lots of choices. And San Francisco has some blessings, actually. You have a pretty decent fresh water supply. You have pretty good transportation, mass transit in the region. San Francisco is known to have some good senses of community, you know, whether it's North Beach or Mill Valley or, you know, any of the surrounding areas in San Francisco. You have a lot of trained activists who are capable of mobilizing to respond to emergencies. So San Francisco is not without resources.
So, Mike, for all those people that are still living in denial, and of course we've heard many of them, and they come up with every, I don't know, it's not every excuse in the book, but every opportunity to say, oh, that stuff's not true, that's not real. But, you know, looking on your website, you see many news articles from newspapers around the globe stating these facts about the economic collapse and people getting out of the U.S. dollar. Can you give some examples of things that might help those people that are sitting there right now not wanting to believe all of this, that there is truth to it?
Sure. First of all, the basic thing you need to understand is for the past 50-plus years, there's been a 96% correlation between greenhouse gas emission and GDP growth. Greenhouse gas emission represents the burning of fossil fuels, whether that be coal, natural gas, or oil, petroleum. You cannot have economic growth unless you consume energy. The two are Siamese twins. Therefore, if there are shortages of oil, or oil prices spike, the only way to curb demand, since supply is no longer something that can be manipulated, the world's producing at full tilt, the only way you can address the equation is through demand. And we've seen a lot of literature over the past 2 years come up about something called demand destruction. How do you destroy demand for oil? Well, you collapse the economy. People who are unemployed or can't afford it don't take long driving vacations. They don't fly on airplanes. They don't buy excessive consumer goods. And so that's the fundamental trap. Now, recently, we have seen an enormous rise in the price of gold, which I predicted and discussed in our DVD, Denial Stops Here, which is our newest DVD. We see a number of countries moving away from holding the dollar. The dollar is the global reserve currency because that's how oil is or has been priced. But we've seen Sweden, Qatar, India, China, Japan, the Philippines, many major nations start to reduce their dollar holdings. They can see the writing on the wall. In the last 7 weeks, the dollar has lost 7 cents in value against the euro. While gold just is astounding everybody, and I encourage all of our subscribers at From the Wilderness to buy physical gold bullion or bullion coins, not numismatic coins like that are valuable because of the date. Because even if you're poor, you make a small purchase of a couple hundred dollars, you may well see that purchase double in value in the very immediate term. But one of the big debate questions out there is at what level will gas prices really get the American consumer's attention? I agree that has not happened yet. I think probably at $4 or $5 a gallon, you're going to see a lot of people start screaming. But what we see now is that the poor are being hit hardest first, as we predicted. We're seeing definite increases in mass transit ridership all over the country, but that's another problem because school districts and police departments in smaller governmental regions around the country can't afford their fuel bills anymore. So, and we can expect to see some blackouts this summer, some serious blackouts that may last for longer than days. that with global instability says it's just time to put your helmet on and see what the music's going to dictate.
So, Mike, one of the things that I'm always hoping for is that people will wake up from their denial, and I always think that maybe if there was a big enough reason, people would be kind of shaken out of their denial state. And I'm curious, you know, sometimes I think that if gas prices just skyrocketed overnight, that would get people's attention. I'm curious, from your perspective, what are your thoughts on all of that?
Well, I think when most people wake up, it's going to be too late.
Mm.
The plain fact is this, is that today there are 6.5 billion people on the planet. Up until the oil age, the global population was fairly stable at around 2 billion people. There was a dip in the 1400s for the bubonic plague. But 4.5 billion people now exist on this planet today because of oil and because of natural gas. 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy and every calorie of food consumed on the planet. That's why the effort to relocalize is very important. Because in the not-too-distant future, we will be limited to eating food that is grown within 100 miles of where we live, and that's the most important part of relocalization. But I don't have that debate anymore about what it's going to take to wake people up. I'm already aware of tens and hundreds of thousands of people who are awake and who are looking for answers, and quite frankly, that's the only group of people I have time for. I just walk away from the others and say, hey, we'll see you when you get it.
Good point.
You spoke last week on the state of the American and world economies, just some factors that are really playing out right under our noses right now. Let's assume that we're connected into that audience of people who are paying attention and intend to wake up or are waking up. What's the current report?
Well, the current report is reasonably grim. I'm just pulling up the speech right here so that I can hit some of the highlights for you. I think it's important that, you know, people have a tendency when they are looking at peak oil to divorce the energy issue from global events, as if somehow there's no connections. But actually, of course, there are enormous connections between global economy and military adventurism and energy. Last year, GM lost $10.6 billion. Ford and Daimler Chrysler are teetering on the brink of bankruptcy behind GM. Toyota is about to become the largest automaker in the world, bigger in terms of sales than all of the America's big three combined. Boy, that is a sign of the U.S. Falling off a cliff. U.S. News reported last December 19th that 800,000 jobs were going to be cut last winter. Now, we don't have the final numbers yet, but it looks like we made that, if that was a goal. The housing bubble has popped. Inventories are swelling. Sales are declining. Prices are softening. Lenders are raising rates. First signs of panic are starting to appear. They're now trying to introduce 50-year mortgages just to keep this bubble afloat. It's Desperation City. I encourage anyone who owns their house and who considers that their savings to sell it now, because you may wake up in a year or 2 years and find out that your house is worth half of what you think it's worth today. Consumer debt continues to skyrocket. Bankruptcies are at an all-time high. Many nations, again, are dumping the U.S. dollar. There's a move. Iran is now back on track to open an oil bourse or a trading exchange on Coast Island that will price oil in euros. But Norway, surprisingly, has advocated the same thing. Clearly, the world is starting to abandon the dollar. And the only way this economy is propped up today is because foreign governments have been buying about $2 billion a day in American paper. They're lending us money so that we can continue to borrow on our credit cards and homes to buy products that we don't need. And debt is looming over the American consumer like you can't possibly believe. Those are the economic factors. If you look at the oil factors, you have more than 33 nations that are the world's leading oil producers that have entered serious decline. Mexico is in decline. Britain, the North Sea, is just falling off a cliff. Norway's in decline. Indonesia's in decline. Some of the biggest. Kuwait's largest field, Bergen, collapsed last year. So if you were to try to talk about finding more oil, it's no longer a question about assuming a flat production curve. You got a production curve declining at 6 to 8% a year now. We need to find three new Saudi Arabias just to offset decline and meet current demand. And, of course, oil discoveries peaked in 1962. the planet for the last 2 or 3 years has been using 6 barrels of oil for every barrel of oil it finds. And probably the capper, as I wrote last year after the hurricanes, Katrina and Rita, is that 23% of U.S. oil production is still shut in the Gulf. It hasn't been repaired. And the Department of Energy said a few months ago that that will probably never be repaired. As we walk into another hurricane season, just weeks away now, with surface temperatures in the Gulf waters 2 degrees higher than they were last year at this time. I mean, this is, looks just like a mess.
Mike, every time I have a chance to speak with you, I am able to take myself into this really broad perspective of America. And what I see is America toddling along now for many years, still in a drunken stupor with a maxed out credit card, holding on to some idealized vision that we had of ourselves in the 50s after we conquered the world. And we took that into the 90s and had incredible economic growth and everything was wonderful. And then we completely lost touch with reality over this whole dot-com thing. And we thought that Amazon stock was worth $300-something, even though they weren't making a profit. So we all got excited, and then 9/11 happened, and what did we do? We drank more, because now the whole situation was totally turned upside down, and we had some crazy guy leading the country to we don't know where, doing stuff that none of us had any idea what it was, but we didn't want to acknowledge what was really going on, so it was easy to just keep on consuming and keep on maxing out our cards.
Well, as I wrote in my book, Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil, it is very clear, and it's established by documentary records, that Dick Cheney knew about peak oil as far back as 1999. We had the Vice President's Energy Task Force right after the administration took office, starting in January 01 and closing out in May, that fought to the Supreme Court twice to keep its records secret, and unfortunately they won. But clearly the government knows at the deepest level what peak oil is and what it means. And as I said in the book, the events in the 5 years following 9/11 will determine the course of human history for probably the next 500 years. And I'm very sad to say that in terms of preparing for peak oil, which I think in the broadest sense the world is, $9 are spent on military and $1 is spent on the actual stuff that it should be spent on. Unfortunately, there is no combination of alternative energies anywhere that will allow current consumption to continue. There are 700 plus million internal combustion powered vehicles on the planet. Hybrids are an absolute joke. It takes about 15,000 gallons worth of gasoline energy to make a hybrid. There's 7 gallons of oil in every tire. If we were to replace all the other cars in the world now, we would create a whole fleet of used cars, which would go on sale to poor people, and then we'd use up the rest of the oil to make hybrids. Americans really need to rethink. The bottom line here is that from a societal standpoint, nothing will work except for reducing consumption now. But we are making mistakes if we try to fix society assuming that society will fix us. That's very much putting the cart before the horse. All survival, as we enter this, what looks to be a very turbulent period of transition out of the age of oil to whatever a post-petroleum world is going to look like, is going to be local. Individuals will not survive and nations will not survive. What will survive are tribes or local community groups of people who take care of each other, who make effort to make sure that their neighborhoods are sustainable. And there's a wonderful lesson being taught right now in South Central Los Angeles, as a matter of fact. From the Wilderness has covered the struggles of the South Central farmers who took a 14-acre plot that they got the permission to use from the city after the Rodney King rebellions, and are now feeding 350 families in the heart of Los Angeles off of this vacant lot, which the city and the owner now want to tear down and replace with a warehouse for Walmart. Oh. But it is possible to sustain life in the city. The Cubans have done it. There's a great new movie we're going to be selling shortly about what Cuba did after the fall of the Soviet Union. And these are the things that people need to start focusing on right now.
So, Mike, what do you see as the best and the worst possible scenarios that might come out of this? So when you're talking about maybe the best scenario is with this sort of tribal arrangement you mentioned, and I don't know what the worst case scenario is, but if you can, I'm just curious from your perspective. I have no idea what to expect, and when my fear takes over, my mind imagines all these crazy things. So I'm curious, you know, what do you think we're actually in for?
Well, of course, we don't know, because when there's a great academic book by Joseph Tainter who wrote The Collapse of Complex Civilizations. And the more complex a civilization, when it collapses or when it starts to come unhinged, is the fact that the possible list of things that can go wrong is magnified by orders of magnitude. There's no way to list all the possible things that could go wrong. So what you would prepare for is chaos, which is probably the worst case scenario. As I say to my subscribers, as I said in my speech, I am not an advocate of making plans. What I am an advocate of is increasing your options. Plans don't bend well with changing circumstances. Plans tend to break. However, if you have options, you can mix and match those options along certain guidelines and have more flexibility. The best case scenario, I would say right now, is that the largest number of people start to relocalize by community. Some who are fortunate enough, like I have been able to do, can relocate to very sustainable regions that will be sustainable for long periods of time. They're all over the country. They're not just in Oregon. Pacific Northwest, Vermont, the upper Midwest, Kentucky, Texas, Ohio, New Mexico, Florida. I mean, they're springing up all over the place. To move in that direction as quickly as possible, we have to understand that the American paradigm is ending. I think the American empire is finished. I think it was terminal after the hurricanes of last year. And not everybody's going to make it. But the idea is, as it is in any emergency situation, and Jim Kunstler, a great writer on the subject of peak oil, has a book called The Long Emergency, and that's exactly what it's going to be. So in an emergency, what you do is the best you can. You save as many people as you can. You have to triage. You have to use good judgment. You have to take care of yourself first, and that's another big message that I put out in my lectures. Which is, there's a reason why on an airliner the flight attendant will say, if the oxygen mask comes down, put your own mask on first, because you can't help anybody else unless you're stable yourself. So on a personal level, reduce debt as much as possible. I am a strong advocate of buying into precious metals to give yourself some economic room. And if you own a house now and you're thinking about selling it, please, for God's sake, get out of that house now while there's still some legs left in the market before it collapses completely. Other than that, we have to do the hard things. We have to talk to our neighbors. We have to talk to our neighbors about things they don't want to hear. And if some neighbors don't want to hear it, find the neighbors who do, and you start working with them. Because there's a lot of skills that are going to be needed, and there's a lot of diversification of skills and talents that can be used to support, where one person might know metalworking, somebody else knows carpentry, things like that. That's important.
Sounds to me like inherent human connection once again.
Indeed.
This is 89.5 KPOO San Francisco, and we are speaking today about peak oil, future solutions, sustainability, and really what's actually going on in our world right now. We're on the line with Mike Rupert, editor and publisher of FromTheWilderness.com. Mike, I wanted to continue here just for a moment on this notion of paradigms. I was ranting a few moments ago about the drunken stupor that America seems to be in, and our collective denial about the state of our geopolitical affairs, the situation with regard to global energy, what's happening with the environment, what's happening with regards to the entire healthcare system that we supposedly have in this country is not set up and designed to actually make people healthy. The fact that we have a legal system in our country that is not set up to actually help people to minimize their disputes, but rather to maximize litigation and actually serve those that are making work off of doing that. That and so many other areas of our reality where we've got major paradigms and systems in place that do not really serve us. And when I hear you speaking about our need to get back to connecting with our neighbor, understanding where we are, actually being conscious about creating a safe and prosperous life for ourselves, these things sound to me as inherently human, or as what we call healthful living. So I agree with you in your speech last week. You say that the paradigm is the enemy. Let's speak a little bit more about these large-scale paradigms that people have stuck in their minds that are affecting the reality that we're all co-creating.
Well, you know, a very, very good friend of mine, Dr. Faz Khan, is the senior emergency room physician at Jewish Hospital in Brooklyn. He's also a Muslim imam. That's great. He was one of the first three physicians on the scene on 9/11, and he's just a wonderful, magnificent human being. And he made this observation about paradigms. He said that a paradigm is what you think about something before you think about it. It's all the assumptions your head makes before you start to analyze that you may not even be aware of, and those assumptions, as Buckminster Fuller might have said, are the ones that trap you in the box. We have to learn to identify the paradigms and the things that we assume are true, and maybe they aren't, because that's how we trap ourselves. One of the great dialogues that needs to be undertaken now is a definition of survival versus or a necessity versus a luxury. I have been in survival situations. I've had a pretty long, hard, tough life. I've been homeless. I've been shot at. I have been shot. I've been and I've been through survival situations. And when you're in a survival situation, whether immediate or protracted, anything that is not a necessity has to go. In other words, if you're packing your bags to get off the Titanic, do you really need to take your personal library with you, knowing that it may drag you to the bottom of the ocean? To mistakenly label a luxury as a necessity really impedes adaptive survival behavior. And so we need to start. I mean, there's too many out there, people out there, fantasizing even today at this late juncture that instead of having an oil-powered luxury liner, we'll have an alternative-powered luxury liner, and that's the wrong paradigm. We want to build lifeboats here, not luxury liners. And you would start from the basics and work up. And once the basics for survival have been met, then you can start to think maybe about a couple of luxuries. But there again, you got to redefine what you need versus what you have to survive. And that's not a dialogue Americans have been conditioned to get into. We've been told we need electric toenail clippers and, custom fingernail painting and all kinds of stuff like that, which is absolutely non-essential.
What are your thoughts on two different schools? Number one, going out and wanting the system to change so that it can be better, or stepping up and being a part of creating a new system, a new way?
Well, I think both are mistaken objectives at this point. I mean, I've been an activist for almost 30 years. I started with CIA and drugs in the 70s. I lived through Iran-Contra, savings and loan, Iraqgate. I mean, all of the majors that have moved activists to the streets. I mean, San Francisco, you have great demonstrations there, you know, sometimes as many as a million people. But has the system changed as a result? No. After 30 years of that kind of liberal progressive activism, the system has done nothing but get worse. So we have to be ruthless in our assessment of what we're doing and how effective it is. We have to look past, oh, gee, do I feel good after going to a march, and ask the question, well, okay, how did the world change as a result of that? So trying to change the system, to me, is utterly futile at this point. This is an out-of-control criminal enterprise. It's an economic system that's getting ready to collapse the United States, which would provoke probably the largest liquidation sale in human history, and this country is ripe to be just sold off piecemeal. That includes the debt for people's homes and everything else. And so your other question was like, okay, so should we try to change the system? And I'm going, show me somebody who actually knows how to do that. Show me somebody who's done it, and tell me how we're going to do that before this summer.
Well, and the people running the system do not, they're happy. They don't care. No one's going to, the system is not designed for it to change by the will of the people right now, unless the will of the people in mass changes and doesn't support it.
Yeah, but still, I mean, I think you're whistling Dixie here. I mean, I have 64 members of Congress who subscribe to my newsletter. I speak to many of them, and many of them are not happy. But they're powerless to change the system also. To engage in some wishful thinking about, gee, if we can just get all the people aroused, I mean, come on, I've been hearing that for 30 years, and it's never happened.
Yeah.
there's a lot of that here in San Francisco. You know, a lot of the activist scene, a lot of energy being thrown in that direction. And I often ask myself, you know, is that really where you want to be putting your focus?
But there's also a lot of activists who have checked out of that paradigm completely and are saying, okay, nonsense. I'm taking my family. I got some friends. We're learning how to make biodiesel at home. We're learning how to can.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to grow gardens. We're working on a local community currency. We're not staging demonstrations. We're actually doing something. And you know what? Those are the people who are going to make it.
So, Mike, you talked at one point about not having a plan but having options, and you were just kind of speaking about that a little bit right now. So what are some of the options that we can start creating so that we have some choices when we need them?
Well, again, the first thing I encourage anybody to do, if they have any means to do it, even in the short term, is to get out of debt or reduce your debt as much as possible. The bankruptcy laws were rewritten for the second time in, I think, 5 years, just last year. The bankruptcy laws are now extremely tough. You could wind up becoming an indentured servant to your credit card company under new bankruptcy laws. You don't have options if you're deeply in debt. Ask anyone who's working two jobs trying to go home and make their minimum payments on credit cards and mortgages. So getting out of debt frees you enormously in terms of providing options. Gold, whatever you can invest in, gold or silver. Junk silver is fine, too. Precious metals are going to go through the roof. I see the path clear to $800 gold in probably a year and a half or less, and $1,000 gold in 5 years. Again, that's almost a doubling of what it is today. You can increase options by learning skills, whatever you may like to do, whether it's mechanics, carpentry, woodwork, how to work on your house, how to garden. Boy, we got some excellent books on sustainability on our website on how you can grow backyard gardens and how you can, on how to kill game. Of course, there's no game really in San Francisco, but in other parts of the world there is. How you can make clothes. How you can stay warm. There are, all kinds of things. This is how you can increase your options in a way that, regardless of what the government doesn't do, and I'm convinced the government's not going to lift a finger to help most of the American people with peak energy. They're concerned about critical infrastructure. As a matter of fact, let me just digress for a second. Probably the most poignant quote, and I've been to 9 countries and we've written stories from 9 countries all over the world with our investigations, was a quote from a Dutch economist who said in 2003, it may not be profitable to slow decline. In other words, as people are sensing now at the gas pumps and otherwise, there's more money to be made by destroying people's lives if net profits are your bottom line. So there's no financial incentive in the current economic paradigm to save lives. That's why people like Catherine Austin Fitz at her website Solari.com, Solari.com, are so valuable because she's traveling around the country helping communities actually create neighborhood stock corporations, to create local currencies, to understand how the money works locally. And the people who are doing stuff like this, again, are the ones who are going to make it.
We actually will have Catherine Austin Fitz on Reality Sandwich 3 weeks from today, and we'll be speaking with her even deeper on this subject about local communities and how to spend our money more wisely.
So have I got you guys thoroughly scared yet?
Always, Mike, always, when I talk to you. But
yeah.
I'm used to it by now. The first time I heard you was on your that 9/11 video, and I have to say I was in deep denial at the time, and I was devastated for about 48 hours. I mean, my world had crumbled, my entire reality. And, you know, after that, everything was I was fine after that. It was kind of like, well, I now know what we're in for, and now I can actually do something. So while it was more than a shock, it was it freed me to the new path that I'm on. So if anybody out there is terrified or freaked out, I encourage you to really explore what's going on and actually move past that into some empowerment.
Yeah, you definitely want to get my book, Crossing the Rubicon, and our videos, Denial Stops Here and Truth and Lies at 9/11, because once you have a good map, even if the situation is bad, there is comfort in knowing of a certainty where you are on that map and knowing that you have a map that you can trust. So that even if it's bad news, you have a better chance of making the right decisions that are going to give you a better chance to get out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I talk to people, everyone loves to solidify their denial by using two words, conspiracy theory. People love to use that. And, you know, it's just like, it's so easy to dismiss things that are right under your nose if you put those two words together. And I always try to clarify with people, look, you know, this is not about, you know, why would I want to go out of my way to start making sense of information in order to freak myself out? No, what I'm trying to do is better comprehend the nature of my reality so that I can have options, so that I can better understand what's going on around me and better take care of myself and those that I love and in my family and my community. So, you know, it's just, listen, people, if you think that talking about what's really happening in the world means that people are conspiracy theorists, then, you know, if you have to take that and you have to use that easy dismissal of your own, using your own intelligence, go for it. But that's not what's happening here. We're looking at specifically what's going on in the world around us, very specific, measurable types of things. And one of the things I really appreciate about your news reporting on From the Wilderness, Mike, is that you always give the source of the information. You always say, where did this come from? This is a fact. This is what we know. There's no conjecture here. And that's the way we have to start looking at things. What's actually going on, people? And I believe that one of the ways out of denial is when reality becomes undeniable, that it's right in front of your face, and that's often what it takes.
Well, the sad part is, of course, is that if you wait until that last possible moment, it's usually too late. But I think on the goodness, there are a bunch of us in the peak oil movement, and I would include in that group myself, Catherine Austin Fitz, Steve Andrews, who is the head of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil USA, Richard Heinberg, Julian Darley, Matt Savinar, many of us who have been out here for a long time, we all are in agreement that a fast crash, something that's very shocking and very devastating, is much better than a slow burn. Because to have a long, protracted, slow burn into collapse allows people to linger in their illusions way too long. Whereas a fast crash tends to wake everybody up like a cold shower. And while there are still some pieces that while the infrastructure is still functioning, that gives you chances to take advantage of solutions that are in front of us. I think one of the biggest mistakes you can make out there, and this is a big mistake in people's thinking, is there's one peak oil activist, I won't mention names, but he's well known. He is already, in a sense, off the grid. He does not own a car. He will not fly on an airplane. He doesn't own a cell phone. And yet he's trying to organize conferences around the country, and he's forced everybody who deals with him back into the 1940s in terms of technology, which is totally ineffective. And you must really structure your plans for short-term versus long-term. It's useless to start planning now that, okay, I'm going to live in a yurt somewhere and go off the grid without thinking about, wait a minute, what's going to happen as human civilization goes through its most radical transformation in history. So you have to prepare for the transition again, and that's where maybe it's not a good idea to give up some of these high-tech things like our computers or our cell phones or our cars, even our jet planes, because I can guarantee you that Dick Cheney and George Bush and the Rockefellers and Bill Gates and all of those people are not going to give up any of those technological or energy-intensive advantages until they have to. And you need to use that stuff as effectively as possible while you're trying to get ready.
Mike, in our final 10 minutes here, at the very end of the peak oil resolution that San Francisco put forth a couple weeks ago, it says here that they ask the Board of Supervisors, urges the mayor to provide funding and direction to city departments for the development of a response plan. Let us just imagine for a moment that something happened and they got it and they had tons of money to put into it. What does San Francisco need to do to make this resolution some sort of, you know, divine act of inspiration and get off our whatever to make this city capable of surviving what's coming ahead?
Well, what I'm, again, now I've got to be clear, this is just speculation on my part. I have no knowledge behind this, but I would be terribly surprised if San Francisco hasn't been developing in secret emergency response plans for energy crises for a good many years. They don't want to make that public because, again, they don't want to cause quote-unquote panic, but more than that, politicians don't want to disturb the financial markets. I think the city has already done that. When I was at the Peak Oil Conference in Denver last August, Again, I spoke to John Hickenlooper, the mayor of Denver, who is himself a former oil exploration geologist, very aware of peak oil. Now, Denver's making all kinds of moves. They've got their school buses running on biofuel now. They've replaced streetlights with very low-energy devices, traffic lights. You know, they're making big plans. So I asked him, I said, well, is anybody in the National Conference of Mayors or a city sharing information? He said, oh, my dear, yes. And he started rattling off a list of cities where planners from the cities have been meeting for, you know, a couple of years now, discussing the reality of this and making plans. You may not know what those plans are. And, of course, every city is going to be different. What's important, I think, is the public recognition, and that's the breakthrough for San Francisco to have passed that initiative. It might encourage some other major cities to do that, or if well-publicized enough in San Francisco, you might just reach some of those people who are still in denial but like on the verge of coming out, and that's what you really want to do.
Hmm.
Well, hopefully the city can get it together. I mean, is it a matter of putting in place some alternative energy? I mean, should we start building tons of windmills? Should we be working on the latest tidal technology? Should we be getting massive blocks converted to city gardens?
Well, the last suggestion is something that can be done in a short period of time, making, you know, turning parks and vacant lots into city gardens. Yes, that's something you can do. Everything else is a pipe dream. Professor David Goodstein, who is the vice chancellor of Caltech, wrote a great book a couple of years ago, and I forget the title, but he basically what he said, one of the things he said in the book was that it takes 30 years to change an energy infrastructure. Do you honestly think we have 30 years?
No.
We're lucky to have 4 months before this really starts to get serious, 4 or 5 months. And again, I have to repeat, there is nothing, no combination of alternative energy that will replace what we get out of hydrocarbon energy. You can't plug a windmill into a 2004 Toyota. It doesn't work. You cannot take a 747 and pull it up to the airport in San Francisco and say, fill it up with technology. It only flies on oil. And you know, one thing that people do not think about in terms of alternative energies is energy return on energy invested. When mankind first found oil fields, for every unit of energy, there was like 100 units of energy returned, because the energy density of oil is what makes it so powerful. Now when we talk about ethanol, which is a joke, it's a handout for the farms and the subsidies to Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill, Monsanto, if we were to plant all the arable land in the United States with corn to produce ethanol, we would replace only 14% of the gasoline we consume every day.
Mm.
How much energy goes into making a windmill? Those big blades are made out of plastic. What's plastic made out of? Oil. The stands for the windmills, they're all made out of metal. It has to be mined. It has to be melted. It's all energy input there. Ethanol almost has a negative return. In other words, it almost produces less energy than it took to make it. So ethanol is no answer, plus you're not restoring the soil. All the biomass, all that plant matter needs to be put back and mulched into the soil, otherwise your topsoil is going to deplete. We are out of balance. You know, windmills might be good. Of course, San Francisco, you got lots of windmills around. But that's only supplying a portion of your energy. But number one, there isn't time, and two, we're having huge commodity shortages around the world for things like steel, copper, iron, cement, because of overconsumption and because we're competing with China for those same things, and China's growing at 10% a year.
So, Mike, I wanted to quote something from what you wrote, and then I have one last question for you. So you quoted Frank Herbert, who wrote the novel Dune, and it says, "I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it is gone, past, I will turn the inner eye and see its path. When the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain." So when we remain, what can we do? Give us in the last few minutes some sustainable things that we can do. You had mentioned some areas that we may want to think about living in. Maybe give us an idea of where we can go and what we can do now to start.
Well, I think we've covered it all in different parts of the show, but get out of debt, reduce your debt as much as possible. Learn about sustainable living, reduce your consumption, but start to work on local food production wherever possible. It is possible to do in a major city. That's a short-term answer that makes a lot of difference. Start investing in precious metals that you keep in your possession in a safe at home, gold, silver, bullion coins. Start learning skills, whatever those skills tend to be. Start meeting your neighbors. Start talking about local sustainability and start making plans under what-if scenarios. At this point, I think it would be criminal for anyone to say, we need to go out and try to convince Congress to do something. That is not going to produce any kind of a result. Just let them that have ears hear and let them that have eyes see. That message is out there, and many, many hundreds of thousands of people around this country are already doing it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mike, how do folks connect in more with you and your website?
Well, you can find us on the web at www.fromthewilderness.com, all one word. We've been publishing now our newsletter for over 8 years, 64 members of Congress. We're in 40 countries with 24,000 subscribers or so, and professors all over the world. We have books, videotapes. A lot of the stuff on our website is free. Part of it is subscriber only because we're doing a lot of investigative journalism. But you can find a whole lot there. We also have links to dozens of other sites of people that are doing really good work around the world.
Excellent. Mike, thank you so much for being on with us today. We look forward to connecting with you again.
Thank you.
Had a great time.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Mike Rupert, editor and publisher of FromTheWilderness.com. And today we were speaking about the peak oil global energy circumstance, what's happening with respect to global economic conditions, and all about sustainability, understanding what we need to do to take care of ourselves and make sure that we can thrive and survive into the future. Absolutely imperative knowledge and information to have today.
So in our last 2 seconds here, I wanted to make some announcements. So there's several things going on. We are going on to this topic of building communities and teaching each other. We are going to be leading a study of the U.S. Constitution so that we can know what our rights are and we can be empowered as individuals and as communities. And that is going to be May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. in The Hate at a coffee shop called Coffee to the People. You can find out more about that on our website as well. And we will have some future shows coming up. We have Mark Lyon, who's going to be on next week talking. Is it next week?
Next week we'll be speaking all about the U.S. Constitution. The show is going to be called Know Your Rights, an overview of the Constitution and an expanded understanding of what that document is and what it means to us every day.
And that will be a lead into the meeting we're going to be holding the next Tuesday. And then this weekend, you've probably heard her on our show before, our fellow friend and artist, MicroPixie, and she's going to be at the Counterpulse in the Mission, actually South of Market Mission and 9th Street, this Friday at 7:30 p.m. May 5th. So feel free to check that out. And you can always find us on healthfulliving.org. If you haven't been to our new website, please go. We have a very largely expanded community of resources and all sorts of fascinating information that we've been talking about on our show, as well as all of our past recorded shows, including the one on Mike Rupert today, at our website, healthfulliving.org.
And if you want to go directly to past shows of Reality Sandwich, you can go straight to Reality Sandwich Radio, where you can also download a booklet for the Constitutional Show next week, so you can follow that and listen along. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist, healthful living advocate with Healthful Living, and this has been Reality Sandwich. We're on every Thursday at noon.
We serve up a palatable taste of the truth. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant. Thanks for listening.
We'll speak with you next week.